I'm not good at raising money, but maybe I'm okay at raising consciousness. And when consciousness is raised, money will follow.
Soul Space, the podcast.
Today I want to introduce you to one of the greatest people I've ever met. I met him in Udaipur in India. And he is one of the founders of an organization who are helping animals. And they started when nobody really cared about animals in India, basically. And they just started a complete movement almost. And if you see in the streets now, people really care about street animals in this city. And I was really touched by the way the animal shelter was created, because there's so much love, so much compassion, and I really wanted to learn more about it and really wanted to ask him how they created it the way it is right now. And just to get some facts across, Animal Aid Unlimited in Udaipur has now over 700 residents, animals who are living there, some temporary, some permanently, and has almost 100 staff members now who are basically coming from the surrounding area. And of course, they have so many volunteers, and we have been one of them, who are helping these animals and, you know, learning a lot about how to treat animals and how to be a kinder person. And if you Google Animal Aid Unlimited, you will realize how many followers this organization has now on YouTube and all the other channels, because they documented their work, and it's just absolutely amazing. So, without further ado, meet Jim. Jim, thank you so much that we actually managed to sit down and talk a little bit, because I'm so curious about you and about your life as well. Because when I first entered the gates of Animal Aid, I felt this is a very special place, because I've felt so much openness, so much peacefulness. And I didn't know how much pain actually exists here, because on the tour we got introduced to some of the animals, and they have so much suffering sometimes and so much pain. And it's even more incredible that this peacefulness is still present. And you, as one of the founders, you what's really incredible for me is how you created this peace and this love and this compassion within yourself to be able to create such a place.
Well, thank you for that nice opening and your sense of coming to Animal Aid in that way, and gives a nice feedback to me and to us about the people that connect with what we're doing and what they see, because I just sort of do it. And sometimes I'm not even aware of what the consequences are of doing it. And in some ways, that's maybe even at the very heart of what you're saying, is that if somebody ends up doing what they kind of care about, they might be playing to their vanity, might be playing really to other audiences. Like, I want to be seen doing some things. Like, we're all raised with comic books about Supermans and Superwomen, and, you know, and being something in the eyes, like successful, being someone who really has fancy shoes and a cool car and a great girlfriend or boyfriend. And if we're not really invested in that, there's a lot of vanity that's in human beings and pride, as opposed to the person who really cares about something. And then they other people see them, And they too know I'm inspired by that person because that person isn't playing to me. I'm not in a hustle. Someone's not trying to sell me a used car. They're doing their work, and I'm watching it, and I'm seeing the environment, and I'm drawn into it because so often in all the emails and all the communications, all of the effort on the part of the world to sell me something, we're relieved if we get to a place where we're presented to something. And probably why animals? In some ways, it could have been a number of things. It would have been something for me personally. And I knew something in me probably when I was just a young person and was very, in the 60s or in the 50s in America, in Los Angeles, going to high school. I had a very normal sort of life. I was a good student in the standard sense of it. I was a general athlete and got, pats on the back for football, baseball, basketball kinds of things. I went to UCLA for the freshman year to play football and left for complicated reasons and went abroad. But I also had a mother who introduced me to literature, and I didn't even know it was normal or not normal, but like I found myself like reading almost all of Dostoevsky's novels walking through the halls of high school, and didn't even know that that was great literature or that it just was interesting and fascinating. And I was introduced to the incredible world of that particular author that was a world ultimately about the challenges of the human spirit. And when you get into that world, you become more attracted to probably the arts. I ended up getting, long story about getting there, but the PhD in British literature and taught in three American universities, and didn't really get into it because I wanted to be a teacher. Though I loved the time of teaching, I thought it was an incredible moment to enter into a classroom of people and be able to present them with poems and stories that were at the core of things in life, and have everyone try to respond to them and find out what's really on our minds and what we're feeling. So, and with being the environment of the issues that were relevant in the 60s, I found that almost all of the very nice conservative things that were in my conservative Republican family, I started in my own spiritual journey at that time, was flipping almost everything, whether it was the politics, sexuality, race, culture, entertainment, the arts. For a while, I was almost a knee-jerk reaction. If my family and uncles and aunts and the world was doing this, then I should do the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. And turns out they did a lot of things right, too. And so, you have to, in growing up, you have to sort out some of the things that are really a blessing if you're lucky enough to get from your parents. And other things, you say, thanks for trying, folks, but I'm going to go a different way. So I entered into the sense of, to put it in a fundamental way, I became impressed with just the simple fact that most religions take up, that you're kind of lucky if you have any gifts. You know, if you have two eyes, that is a blessing. And you don't even learn that that's a blessing until you've met people that have no eyes. Then you say, oh, I get it. What would it be like to have no eyes? What would it be like if you were deaf? What it would be like if you were black and you're white? What if you were black and poor? What if you were black and poor and gay? How isolating, how far away you'd be from the center of the culture, and could you live that way? What if you felt you were being hunted down in that world that you were in because you were the stranger in that world? So literature allowed me to have thousands of experiences that I didn't have to suffer through. I could read through them. I didn't have to die and be tortured in the Russian Revolution. I could read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Chekhov. I didn't have to suffer through the English world of what happened in the 30 Years' War. I could read the great poets and writers and the novelists from Shakespeare to Milton to Chaucer. And I could read into anti-Semitism and the Dreyfus case and Proust and understand what it means to be a marginalized person. And when I was healthy, smart enough, and athletic enough, and white and healthy, this was my planet in terms of being a young man in California. This was my world. And it caught me in the right time to say something like a feeling of enjoy it, but a great deal of the world. And the more I looked into it and went and traveled and went to India and went to Israel and lived on a kibbutz for a while and was in Greece and was meditating in the world, I saw how much, what great fortune of health and country, and that no one had a war in my city. I wasn't ducking undercover, you know, when bombs were coming, and so when I saw America going off into wars and into the world, that 2 million plus Vietnamese, you know, were killed against Geneva Convention, that it was not allowed at that time and agreed on by America that you cannot use families and the elderly and citizens as part of a terrorism. And we were going out in the name of this kind of peace. And I started to see that in some ways, some other people in the world didn't see us as freedom fighters that we thought we were. They saw us as terrorists coming into South America, destabilizing democracies because we wanted to put in a conservative person that would give economic advantage to Americans' entrepreneurship to get money. And so I didn't become deeply anti-American, but I brought it down. I started, and my history taught me that we absolutely gave and took everything we possibly could from the American Indian, and we had committed a genocide on these people and took their land and their opportunity, and that gave us strength. 30 million black people were taken out of Africa. That gave England and Spain and America and France an opportunity to get economic advantage next to the rest of the world on the backs of innocent people. And while I was going along being a kind of an average Christian, it caused me just to think that the Jesus Christ that I read that said, you know, give all your cares away and come follow me, that I didn't know anybody who was wanted to give up anything to follow a spiritual adventure. Not one credit card to give up to go follow the dangerous life sometime, but the spiritual life that challenges one to think that looking after yourself should be co-identical to looking after others. And there is no getting better on your little pillow if those around you are suffering. So with that attitude, I ended up teaching at a university where I taught James Baldwin's Another Country. I was told not to teach it because it had gay and white and black relations, and that there would be trouble. But because of freedom of speech, they couldn't stop it, but they could fire me. And they, you know, as for other reasons, invent other reasons. So after 3 years in a small family, I did teach the book and was removed from the university. There was a sit-down strike, and I left with some of the people who understood that I was unfairly treated. And we went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and started a commune in Glorieta, New Mexico, that was the idea of having a new educational approach to the world that would review and look at how we're raised. And we shouldn't be raised in universities, and our curriculum is set up for General Motors and others to be ready to do what they need. Yes, we need work, and that's good to be attentive to that. But the point of a great university should be, as Aristotle told us all so long ago, simply, it should have no economic advantage at all. It should be a place to be educated, to be a good citizen. And then after that, you figure out where will I work and who will I marry and what will I do. But you want to be, and a good citizen means just a good human being who knows yourself, knows your history, knows your culture, knows music, and knows the things that are available in the world, and to study them and learn them, but not for any other end product, to find out what are your five senses? Do you have any special talents? Doesn't matter if somebody else is a great writer, can you write? You might enjoy Van Gogh, but you could paint too. You could play the piano too. Do you even know it? Did you even get in an educational system that even brought it out to you? So all of these things, and because I'm 78 years old now, there'd be many chapters that I could go on and on about that how I got to this place. But to basically say that as raised as an Episcopalian in California, white and privileged in all of that, I taught English literature for some years, English literature, and I was then when I was not able to teach, I went to a commune. That also caused the experiences that ended my marriage at that time, and the three kids that I had with their mother went to Seattle, and there were no jobs available for teachers in English literature at that time. So I went there to be near them and had a home that I rented so where the kids could come and be with me. And because I wanted to be a father more than I wanted to be a teacher of English literature, because I could bring my books with me, but I couldn't bring my kids with me to other places. So that caused the sort of radical change that got me into looking at the world differently, with, you know, some years of teaching behind me, so many years, you know, in school. What do I do in the world now without that? And someone approached me, actually, from the United Jewish Appeal program, that had known me on a trip that I took in Israel. I'd studied on a kind of a scholarship for 1964 for a year at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and had met some people that said, look, you're sort of know as much about Judaism as I do and other people, and they're looking for fundraisers to help with charitable needs in Israel in the 15 states in the northern United States. So I said, I don't know that. Do you know that I'm not Jewish? And said, don't worry. If you care about these issues and do it, we can go with it from there. And so for 3 years, I was hired to go from Alaska to Montana and Oregon and Seattle to sit and organize groups of people in those cities to raise money for Israel and for humanitarian needs in Israel. And then that led to people seeing, and I must have done it reasonably well, because the city of Seattle, after the 3 years, said they'd like to hire me to be the director of fundraising for 30,000 Jews that lived in Seattle. So I said again, do you know I'm not Jewish? And I'm the one that is talking here as I present, because I don't raise money. I told them when I started, I'm not good at raising money, but maybe I'm okay at raising consciousness. And when consciousness is raised, money will follow. And I'm not interested in raising money, but I will raise the problems of other people in need and get no benefit from that myself, but will set up opportunities to have people help people. And so I was, and then some of the people that were involved there said there's an opportunity in Seattle. The first $10 million campaign was being run in Seattle to create some endowments and funds for the University of Washington School of Medicine. So some of the Jewish people that were on the board there that knew me and asked me to consider taking up that role. So I did organize the campaign, lived sort of in the university for 3 years, raised the $10 million, and in the course of this, hired a lady that became my wife, Erica, who wrote the language surrounding a $1 million endowment for one of the medical services that were there. And when this program ended, I had noticed something in the New York Times of an ad for a position at Mount Scopus College in Melbourne, Australia, and sent it off as a kind of a whim. And they responded. Again, it was I didn't even know at the time, but it was a Jewish school, the largest Jewish school in the world outside of Israel, 2,000 students, mainly Holocaust survivors, with the source of a lot of it, and interviewed with someone, and again had to tell the community in Australia, they flew me to Australia, and to say, again, folks, I am going to be the presenter of the needs that you hear in funding and endowment and schools with the principal, and I'm not Jewish. And they said, look, you seem to have a track record. They called people and whatever. So we were there 6 years and had our daughter, Claire. And toward the end of that time, because I had such a fabulous trip to India, that first time when I'd gone to Israel and Greece, and I was like 19, 20 years old, that I convinced her to take a trip to go to see India. And she wasn't that interested in it. She wanted to go to some other countries and why India? And she had never gone to Europe, and there seemed all sorts of places that seemed like a worthier place, you know, to go to. And then after we were there one day, she said, why haven't you told me about this more earlier? Because this is a knockout. This is so interesting and so opening up more than just cultural differences that are typical because of skin and because of language, and that life is conducted at a different pace than the West, and how people greet and meet and move with each other and feed and care and tenderness and concern are just different there. Not necessarily always better, but just different. So when we finished our time in Melbourne, Australia, we knew that it would be interesting to come to India. And we started traveling. We liked Rajasthan. Then we found Udaipur. And when we were here, it was our daughter was like 6-7 years old, and it was going to be an issue of what country she was going to be in. And she was a bit of a shy girl, so to be in America or to be in India, she didn't want to. She was losing friends on both sides, would start a relationship and leave it. So and it was just where I was close enough to retirement that we just said, let's take a try it for a few years. Let's come a couple months a year to India and see if we're really liking this. And as we were here, we were looking into, like, what would we really do here? We both knew. She was also somebody who had worked on social things and rights issues, 15 years younger than me, but had that for that next generation was concerned with labor issues and was a part of labor strikes and wanting to help out in the labor movement and had been a long animal lover. So neither of us were vegetarians at that time, but when right before we left, I read Peter Singer's book on the animal revolution. He had actually been a professor at Monash University in Melbourne before he got his post in Princeton on animal rights and these matters. And I was enough at the brink of it that just kind of, I remember standing up from a couch that I was on when I finished the book saying, I guess I'm a vegetarian, you know, and that was already, we had been, you know, going to India, and it just fit in with all of that. And, but I, while I had been involved in the gay, the women's issues, out of Vietnam, mm-hmm. I had kind of kept animal rights in brackets mm-hmm. and hadn't really opened it up to look at. I'd loved each of the pets that I'd ever had, the dogs and the cats, but had not really opened this all up. And as we arrived here on our trips, and I went to the jails. My idea of exploring a city is to go to the waterworks, go to the jails, go to the place where they dump the garbage if you want to learn about a city. And go to the Taj Mahal, but also go to the electric company and go to the general government hospital and go through the wards and sit in a place and listen to see how things are delivered to people that are out sitting outside with their families waiting to be attended to because they're so poor and have come in 50 kilometers away with a sick person. And so that was something that as we were looking for what we would do in coming back here, we even went out looking for the possibility of a orphanage. But every place that we looked, we were finding injured animals. And we were vegetarians at that time, both of us. But I wanted to do something we thought that the Indians needed, not just what I wanted to impose upon them. And in the course of doing it, we were finding injured animals in the process of our general, and we found there was no place to take them, and we learned there was no place to take them in India, except for a few cities, some of the big cities that had these services. So this was the thing that caused us to say, look, every, that's a lovely cow, by the way, if you're hearing that in the distance. I'm sitting here in this lovely interview, and a cow has just come up to say hi. That we saw that every social group, from blind, deaf, or children, battered women, had people that were dealing with their problems, but no one was dealing with the problems of the injured street animal. So we made a commitment to try, let's think about this and do it. And that led to us saying, we can't do this at arm's length. We can't go back and forth and do it. To do this is a huge commitment. And the famous Longshore story being made short with 1,000 different things happening in between, we sold our home in America. We took our girl, Claire, out of school. And maybe we better just for one second. So we made the decision to think that we could help animals. We got a home in a village. We forced our way in and got a family to sort of accept us. And we built a couple rooms in the village. And this is sort of fundraising and friend-raising, you know, that we told them that I would build some rooms for them that they would have, and they didn't have to pay me. But then they could give me sort of 10 years that I wouldn't have to pay rent here. Mm-hmm. So I gave them all of that. And then they ended up helping us get the land in the village, just their own land, but to rent it. It would help their karma, their love of animals and what they were doing, and that we could begin a small shelter there. And we were there for 4 or 5 years, and it just, this was before all of the Googles and the, you know, all the handheld phones, and there was a, we had no personal phone, only one phone in the village that for emergencies. So we got actually 4 or 5 years to try to do this on our own without a sense of rush. But once the technology came and we put posters in hotels, and then people, the internet started, and we got the idea of getting, telling our stories at a website that eventually built into 3-4 minute videos that surprised us all by not only creating a worldwide popularity. My daughter tells me that there's now over 2 billion views, and we have a number of individual animals that have had 5, 10, 15, 20 million views, and with that have raised the funds to have us develop. And we do traditional fundraising that I used to do, just going to people and businesses and looking for funding and from those kinds of typical sources. But this really put us, and not only was it a money raiser, it was a consciousness raiser. And people from all over Europe and America, there's any number of people that have actually come here where they saw not the country, but they saw Animal Aid and saw something in the workers, in the sense of volunteers being accepted and the care, that made them feel that this was a place that they would like to go. And people started making 10, 15-day trips, month-long, making multiple trips. Several of our people now have been 3 and 4 years with us, people who have completely employable in European, American, Australian jobs, but would rather be in a place that has welcomed them in to care for animals. And we help to give some of them who have real job functions a minimal salary if they're a vet nurse or something like this. Otherwise, they'll just come at their own expense. And I think the nature of the people coming who are actually working has created the atmosphere that was mentioned at the beginning of why does this feel like a nice place. And it turns out that it's just letting a good thing be available, which is, it's because there has been suffering, because they've been hurt, the injured animals, helping them becomes something that people do together. And each of us needs help. And most of the people that stay here long enough find that whatever little anxieties they've been carrying in the world, however they thought their bad leg or their headache or their inability to get a boyfriend or a girlfriend or get into this school or things that they made as important, they found that being in a place where they were really helping another creature that needs it now in a very immediate way, help them sort out their lives. And good people attract good people. So people would be coming here for a day and then walk away. And many of these people told me this later. They just missed something when they went away. And they missed themselves being in a place where not only, like, politically, you can talk about animals and caring for them, where you're not seen as strange or weird. You're not defending vegetarianism or veganism or choosing to help animals. But you're also finding that these other nice people that you're here with have found a place for themselves, and that you have a chance to find it here yourself. And so some do, and some have stayed. Some, we have a couple people that for probably once a year, for the last 10 years they've come here, and it's just a pilgrimage in their life to, instead of taking their regular vacation to Hawaii or some European visit, it's just the place they come to remind themselves, get squared away with who they are, and enjoy themselves in the company of like-minded souls. And so all of the, to kind of wrap up the who I am, and I lived on the kibbutz, and I worked with all those issues. I left the church, but I didn't, I was a spiritual person who, now the spiritual in the sense that I think there's more to life than just, you know, eating and feeding and being a sensual creature. That's all wonderful and great. But there is more, especially there's more when many of the people that you know in the world are not even getting that. And they're not even available for this, a spiritual, poetical, musical vision, because they can't even feed their children properly. So all of those things came together. And I like the fact that at the end of my efforts to kind of help people directly, there's no bigger nobody who than the abandoned street animal. No name, no interest in a local population, but it gave me and my wife the pleasure of helping the nobodies. And as just one example of all the nobodies, and it could be today people fleeing from Yemen and people fleeing in Africa because there's tribal strife, and it could be, you know, every country that has their own examples of disadvantaged human beings. So at the end of the day, it's really about working against the bully, that might should not be right, and power should not have sway just because it's powerful. And so finding a community and a place that is sort of my kibbutz and my church and my club, but without a name in that sense, without a theology, without orders and rules of who's good and bad, apart from just being kind when you're here to and helpful to the animals that are here. People can come and find their own level and their own measure of what they want personally. And I'm as happy. I've gotten great news from people who've been here, who've written back, say, a year later and say, I couldn't come back, but I'm doing more work in my small town with animals. Or I will come back, but I heard that, and what one person actually wrote, it, there's real problems in Romania, and you taught me to go, you guys are doing really well there, and they have no help there. So I want to go and try to be brave out there and go to Romania and see if I can help, where people are like hunting dogs for sport, you know, and that sort of thing. So it's like I don't know where people are going to go. And fortunately, online and by people visiting here, we have now 85 or so people. It's not inexpensive. It's about $35,000 a month. We get no government support. And the people who come here, it's all funded by individuals who thinks that this, that they want to have a place like this in their lives. And we invite them in to claim it, to say, you can, this is yours. You can pay your spiritual rent, in whatever currency you want to. Come and work, give something, give money, put it in your will, whatever you want to do. And it'll keep this alive for you and for the next generation. And so in broad strokes, I'm 78 and I'm working with my daughter who's 30 and my wife who's 65, and we're doing what we can to have, with all the people who come here, to help in the great circle of helping animals to help ourselves know each other better. And it probably all starts with everyone getting a hold of rescuing yourself. We're not really ready to go out and rescue the world until we think we're living with a good person, that we're, the person we're with is funny, the person we're with is kind, that we talk to, the I, me, that has our inner life be valuable or not. And when we get that worked out and like to go out and be in our company, and where loneliness is really not even a word that's in your spiritual vocabulary, because you're never alone, that, and while I'm saying this, a buffalo is just coming to say hello to me, that many other things will fall in place about what is, not just what is my work, who's my mate or my buddy, but the most important thing of how do I do life? It's not be rich, be a doctor, be a dentist. It's who am I doing that? Am I graceful? Am I funny? Am I entertained? Am I generous in whatever I'm doing? And get away from all the public shame and the and India has been wonderful in that regard. When India has so many problems in its own way that it doesn't have any vanity about problems. That a person with a scar across their face can have trouble in America and worry over it. In India, it's usually, that's just Dilip, and he's got a scar on his face, and that's it. That's all there is. So I'll wish anybody well. Go look at our website at Animal Aid Unlimited. And better yet, in Udaipur, Rajasthan, India, the door is open for anyone to come and be a part of the Animal Aid experience.
That's so wonderful. I even got some tears. No, for real, like,
but it's okay.
You only know when something special is there when you know there's so many places where this is not there. Like, right. I was working in so many places where there was people were treated so badly. Like, really, they worked their asses off for this company and they were just dumped, basically. Yeah.
And we learn by contrast. You're right. You know, Spinoza said that early on. We almost don't know anything except by contrast. And that's where experience becomes so important, that we learned, like you say, by seeing that there was trouble. And until I was in a privileged community, Palos Verdes Estates, could just tell you that I was, I didn't even meet a Jewish person. There were no black people. And there was no sense of who's gay or not. Everything was in the closet in the late 40s and 50s in America. So it just looked like nobody basically had problems. And as I went out in the world, I thought, uh-oh, wait a second. A lot of the world is in trouble. And I was just in a little kind of nice bubble in the place I was at. And then you find out, if you're lucky, you find out that you were actually didn't know until you saw that with all that trouble is actually more, the world is more interesting than the world that you were in without trouble. That you were living with a kind of boredom, that everything came and it was easy. You weren't challenged and when you got into the real difficulties, then you're called on things in you that you never were called on. And in trouble, you find yourself out when you meet the stranger and you're not spooked and you're not, not afraid. And so, it is a very important process that is spiritual in nature. It gets right down to, you know, what is good and evil. And we even don't even know what those things mean until we've been ashamed of ourselves. Then we find out, not that someone said, oh, that's naughty, but that you feel badly. Maybe you were playing around with some salt with a snail when you were young and you killed it by putting salt in it, and it did, or did something to a bird or a dog or whatever. Or you punched someone in the school just because you could, because they were a little fat boy and weak, and you took advantage of someone in some place. And you learned who you were when you became ashamed, and hopefully rose higher than that. We're all a work in progress, and we're not stuck with any name, you know, that we're good or bad, or relative terms that are always evolving. And I think the great day is the day that is viewed as your spiritual life, that you get up in the morning and you want to get up and you're there and you live your day. And when you like pull the switch on the light as you go to sleep, your life is over. You've finished your that's a life. It's your existence, and you're going to become unconscious again, and you're going to wake up in the morning, and it's all going to be new to you and your response to it. It is not the same world. You can never put your foot in the same river twice, as Heraclitus said. You know, it's always changing and moving. And if we don't bring it down to the preciousness that it is in its moments and the responsibilities to those moments, the things that are needed, because it turns out maybe the next day when you wake up, there's still an injured dog. You're still in the midst of an argument with a friend. You know, and there's carryover, and you regroup with yourself, and you do another day and try to be better in that day, and not get as tangled up in what pension fund do I need that'll give me the best interest, so in 30 years from now, I can have a safe landing in some place. And yeah, think about the future, yes. But if all of your thoughts are about getting ready for a certain kind of future, you'll end up never being in the day you're in. You'll be always planning for your vacation, planning for retirement, planning for something. And you hardly do the thing, and you're often planning for the next thing, instead of with friends, with people you like, and ultimately with yourself. That when if you walk down a street by yourself at night and you're just going to your car, being with yourself in that time and not about where am I headed, what is a bummer, what is good, what is bad, that chat about with your ego that just goes on and gone, but just settle and just way up in yourself the difficulties that are within you, and then give time for that, at least, you know, give time for what you really navigate with, and what we all need to kind of fix our directions in what stars we're following, and then prepare for it. So anyway, yes.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for creating this beautiful place. Thank you for making this much work on yourself and realizing these things. I feel like every human being that is working on himself or herself is doing a favor for the whole world. And so thank you very much for that. Yeah.
Well,
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you. Yeah. Jim is a very special guy. When I first met him, he was picking up cow poo, basically. And only after a while I realized that there was the one of the founders of this place. Because he just looked like a normal volunteer. And I guess that's what intrigued me. That was the point where I thought, this is a very special man. And after this interview, I now realize that it's not really about the thing that he created. It's not about the animal shelter that makes him special. It's the way he thinks, and it's the way that he sees life, basically. Because, as he said, he thinks that it has a high value when you live a day and you're fulfilled in this day, where you're not striving for a next goal tomorrow, but you're completing a life within this day. And that's such an amazing way of living, because then you're basically forced to be in the present. And as we all know, the present is the thing where we live, and the only thing that really exists. And when we think about future and the past, we are very, we are afraid and we're neurotic maybe sometimes and just feel unhappy. And I guess that's why he had such a life. That's why he took so many challenges and created this place in the end, and just did what he thought was necessary to do without thinking about what others might think or what others believe. And another thing that I realized within this conversation was that it doesn't matter how you create this place, what intentions you have, and how idealistic your ideas are. It's all about who you are and who the people are that are holding this place. That's the most important thing. And everything else will come from this. And then something like Animal 8 will become possible.